Hey, folks, welcome back to the DC3Cast. My name is Brian. With me, as always, are Vince and Zach. Vince is almost dying, folks. Give him some sympathy.
Almost.
But we are here to talk about exactly one fourth of a comic, I guess. We'll get to that
like
in a minute.
Maybe a third.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. First, we're going to talk about some news that, or I guess rumors that broke this week. So we've all heard over the last few months, mainly from our friend Uncle Rich at Bleeding Cool, that there is going to be a new DC imprint line event that they're calling like the Ultimate Comics of DC, right? So like the Marvel's Ultimate Comics, but at DC, and Scott Snyder has been the rumored showrunner, brain behind it. Whatever it is, you know, this week it came out that, or Rich Johnson from Bleeding Cool put out an article that, and then a clarification of that article, because his article was very vague, as Rich's stuff often is, that basically what he knows is that this is going to be a line within DC that will take place within the DC multiverse, but will not be sort of breaking continuity as it's currently constructed. So it's not like the new versions of these characters are taking over from the classic versions. But Rich did say that, you know, one of the reasons they're doing this in the multiverse is so that there is some potential for crossover, and there is, you know, I'm sure that in a year or two there will be a story where like Superman dies and the Absolute, which is the name of this Absolute DC, the Absolute Superman will replace him for a while. Like, I'm sure there'll be stuff like that that is happening, but I want to get your sort of take on this, because I think we all had different ideas what this meant. Even after that first article came out, I think we all thought it was going to be in continuity, like the way that, as Vince said in Lad's Chat, Marvel Knights was at the time, like this sort of imprint within the main continuity. But Zach, I want to start with you. What does Absolute DC get you fired up at all?
So I didn't think it was going to be that. I thought it was going to be what it is now being said to be, that it was going to be like a true ultimate thing. I would have been way less interested if it was a like normal in continuity thing. If it was like a Marvel Knights thing, I would have checked out immediately.
Why?
Because I want, what are the things that I get excited about? It's anything that's Kingdom standalone Hearts and disconnected from everything else, for the most part. Like I
Kanye
stand for the Krakoa book stuff, the new Ultimates book, the new Ultimates line, I mean. So I want something that's like small and self-contained that I can obsess over and like fully invest myself in. And if that's what this is, then, I don't know. Maybe comics will be back.
We can only hope that's the case. Vince, what do you think about this potential plan?
Well, the only reason I brought up the Marvel Knights comparison in the first place was because Rich's first column was so confusing.
Right, exactly.
Because in that first column, he suggested that these would be in continuity, and I guess in a way they are, if he's specifically saying like it's its own Earth that will interact with the Prime Earth. But certainly that first column was confusing about that, because it did suggest that perhaps these were books that would be editorially less fettered than the mainline ones, with bigger writers and probably bigger price points, but that they would be somehow within the confines of the continuity, which is the Marvel Knights thing, which is, I was thinking about that the other day, and that's so weird, because like the Fantastic Four was broke in the Marvel Knights Fantastic Four book. Like, they didn't have any money and they had to move out of the Baxter Building. And I don't remember if that was ever reflected in the other comics, you know, or if that only happened in that one. I'd have to go back and look, but it is weird that that ever happened in the first place at Marvel, right? Like,
yeah,
that there was this incontinuity line that was, and actually, if you go back and look at, because I did this yesterday, if you go back and look at, I think it was Joe Quesada's quotes about Marvel Knights, the quote is eerily similar to what Rich was saying about this. But now, you know, Rich updated that article today and was more clear about this being more like Ultimate Marvel, which, you know, that's great. I'm down for whatever as long as the books are good, right? And like any initiative, I think some of the books are going to be really good and some of them will probably be misfires. And you know
well,
me.
We're already down a little bit by the fact that Donny Cates may not be working on it.
Yeah, we are upset about that.
We're all really upset about it.
We're heartbroken over here.
What was I saying? Oh, but you know me, cause, like, as the resident NFL draft fan of the DC3, the prospectus of whatever event is coming up is more exciting to me than the actual thing. So, you know, when we get teases out about the books and when we get creative lineups, I'm gonna be giddy as a little schoolgirl. And you know, when the actual books get here, I'll probably like, you know, one or two or three of them, but and the rest will be persona non grata or whatever. So yeah, the story remains the same for me as far as like my excitement level. I'm always excited for new lines of things. And I think I was talking on the show not that long ago about how I missed the big creative waves. Like, I always like when they announce, like, you know, two or three new books in a set of solicitations. But I really love when they take the whole line and they shake it up and they put out like 26 new title, you know, renumbering everything. Like, it's just, it's the Marvel Now thing, right? Is so satisfying to me. And I know a lot of people don't like it because they tire of the new number ones thing. But like, if we're honest with ourselves, like, comics, just like, if we want these things to survive, they probably need to do that more than they do.
Right.
Well, and just let people get tired of it. Mention that, because like, I was also just thinking about how long it's been since we've had one of those, either at DC or Marvel. Like, I know Marvel DC had the Dawn of DC, but that was almost nothing. That was like a trickle feed of new books that just kind of felt like the normal pattern, you know?
Yeah, it was just presented in like a slightly novel way because they had the big roadmap. But
right, yeah. And like, Marvel's not had a big like Marvel Now type branding since like, gosh, I think like since before COVID, you know. I think the last one was that the Marvel Legacy thing that they did.
Yeah, or Fresh Start. Wasn't there one called Fresh Start or something like
that? See, I thought Fresh Start might have even preceded that, but maybe you're right. Maybe Fresh Start was the last one. So, but it's been a long time. And yeah, I feel like comics need to be doing that more often to like at least keep us interested.
Right.
Yeah, it's cynical and almost silly to say it, but they really do. I'm sorry.
So here is my general thought on this. I do not give a shit about these like Ultimate Universe type things. This is exactly what I'm not interested in terms of Cape Comics. I like my continuity pretty much all together all the time. And so, you know, this isn't really as exciting to me as if it was that Marvel Knights type thing where there was just a concerted effort. Like, you know, what I liked about Marvel Knights was, okay, they took these characters that people weren't really jiving with at the time, and they brought in interesting creators and tried to tell more interesting stories within those things. To me, I would rather them put their energy and get like five great people to, you know, take on the five books that they feel they needed the most help with. That is way more interesting to me than to do this like fake alternate Earth thing that will probably go away in a couple of years. Like that's the thing. Even with the Ultimate Universe, like aside from, like, is there anything that has survived till now?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, like Miles.
But Miles is now in the main universe.
Right, but they still reference the fact survives. That he's from... I mean, yeah, they still reference that he's from the Ultimate Universe time. And the Maker, too. I mean, those are, like, the two characters that came over from the Ultimate Universe when it collapsed. And, like... But now they're telling, like, new stories involving... Well, we don't really know yet, like how this new Ultimate stuff is connected to the old stuff, even though it definitely is in some way. But it's all like that's the thing is like it's all still continuity, you know, it's all still in continuity.
Right.
It's just another. This is almost more Elseworlds, really, is what it is.
I guess so. I don't know. I am just not as interested in the alternate Earth stuff. I don't think that this is a way to really make, how do I say this? If you really want to fix what's wrong with DC, I don't think adding an imprint to it is the thing that's going to fix it.
Yeah. No, I do think, like, the rumored talent roster potentially could, which we don't have very many names, you know, but that would be a shot in the arm for DC. But that would be the case whether they were writing within the universe or creating their own, you know?
Exactly, yes.
What I'm more interested in is seeing... I wonder, there will be no way to prove this because no one will probably talk about it, but what is the compensation going to be like for these books versus the regular ongoing titles? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
if these companies, it's quite obvious to me and to everybody really over the last few years that Marvel and DC, are letting a lot of their top talent kind of drift away and find more success in creator owned, and that the compensation is just not there to attract like the really big names, you know.
Well,
someone like, go ahead.
No. I was gonna say, finish your thought. I do have a corollary to that. Yeah,
just like one big name would be saying like Ed Brubaker has no reason to come back to DC or Marvel at this point in any meaningful way. And it would be nice if DC and Marvel would start compensating creators in a way that like inspires them to come back and do work with these characters that like the creator own thing. It's insanely important for these creators to like own their own work, right, and make money and make residuals off of things that they own, and corporate IP, like, it is what it is. But it would be nice if every once in a while like big writers really felt like coming back and working on these characters because it was worth it to them as well, you know.
Right,
certainly these companies make enough money to be able to do that, and you've got your Hickmans that seem to stick around no matter how. I mean, how many times I thought Hickman was going to leave for creator owned and that was going to be that, you know, and he just keeps coming back to Marvel. Hopefully compensation has something to do with that, but then hopefully that compensation starts to, forgive the terminology, but like trickle down to every,
right.
Every person that worked, you know, hopefully like a rising tide raises all ships or whatever. I won't count on it, but that's what's interesting to me. Are they promising some kind of compensation for coming and doing this? That's sweetening the deal.
Well, so what I was going to say before is I think there was actually a smaller announcement this week that maybe hinted at that being the case, which is that James Tynion is bringing back he's doing a sequel to The Nice House in the Lake.
The girl in the house across the street from the murdered girl in the house.
But so Tynion is coming back for a second season of that at DC, and I feel like that might be a clue that he's also part of the Ultimate Comics thing, because Tynion has been away from DC for a bit now.
Yeah, and he's Snyder's buddy too. So
yeah, exactly.
Really.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a huge swinging a guess there, you know, for me it's pretty obvious. But I wonder if we're gonna see more people like that. Like I don't, as cool as it would be to get Neil Gaiman, Ed Brubaker, the people who are, you know, comics legends, as cool as it would be to get them back, I don't think that's gonna happen. But I think you might see the sort of tier just below them, the people who left for creator-owned work 3 or 4 years ago, your James Tynions, your Steve Orlandos, your Jordy Belairs, people like that maybe coming back. And I think that depending on what they're working on, that stuff could be interesting. Do we have anything else to say about the business side of it before I ask you some like creative questions about it?
I've got nothing but reckless speculation about the business side of things. So we can move on.
Zach, sure, anything you want to add?
No.
All right. So we've been told these are going to be, quote, radical reinventions on a scale of like the Ultimate Universe to Just Imagine Stan Lee. Like how radical do we think it's going to be in terms of reinventions of these characters? And again, we don't know anything. We're just speculating. So speculate away.
I kind of feel like they'll get pretty nutty with it. I feel like if you're going to do this, like you're going to want to go all in. Like I think that these will be bigger shakeups than the New 52 were.
Oh, because they can be, right? There's no real consequence for it if it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine. I don't know. I don't know if I do. I can't imagine what that would look like because, let me answer the question by talking about something else that was like picking at my brain a little.
Okay.
What I would like out of this, I think, would be for the absolute DC universe to be like your classic evergreen, like this is where the Bruce fans go to get their Bruce Wayne Batman, right? And like this is where you see, like, it doesn't mean there can't be like reinvention or, you know, but nothing so much that would take away from like the iconic nature of these characters. And then you could have the main DCU get nutty with like moving the timeline forward and shuffling off some of the older characters and putting legacy characters in their place. And kind of the thing that was supposed to happen when we were talking about 5G and the timeline. And this is me being completely Pollyanna, because the thing that makes more financial sense for DC is to have their cake and eat it too, by keeping Bruce Wayne the Batman in both universes and just flooding the market with more and more Bruce Wayne Batman books. I understand that, but God, in a like when this was announced, in a perfect world in my mind, it's like Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo continuing their Bat story pretty much unchanged and letting the DCU one, like the Earth Prime proper one, move on to like a legacy Bruce taking more of a back seat, somebody else becoming Bat, you know what I mean? Like the time skip thing that I talk about all the time that I wish they would do. The manga thing, where there's an actual timeline that advances and characters age and change. And it won't happen. But I mean, this is such an opportunity.
This is why you just read Savage Dragon comics, because this is essentially the Savage Dragon verse here.
Right. And eventually it just turns into hardcore pornography for some reason.
and Steve-O Willie's there.
Well, I do hope that happens.
That has happened in Savage Dragon, as we know.
In DC, at DC.
I know.
But no, I think that would be such an opportunity to give everybody kind of the thing they want, because I think fans of Snyder and fans of the idea of an absolute universe would just love like iconic versions of the characters rather than radically different ones. Now, since that's not what we're going to get, I guess I am excited to see how nutty they'll get. I just can't imagine what they'll do. I can't imagine what interest Snyder has in writing a Batman that's fundamentally different from the Batman we're already getting. You know what I mean?
I'd be really surprised. Well, okay. I guess I wouldn't. I was going to say I'd be surprised if Snyder takes Batman again, but maybe I wouldn't be. Have you seen the rumors that at one point he was working on a Nightwing book that was maybe going to be a Black Label thing?
Yes, he was. I believe he was crowdsourcing ideas, or not crowdsourcing ideas, but you know that thing he used to do on Twitter where he'd be like, "What would you think if somebody messed with Batman's origin in this way?" And then a bunch of fans would go boo, and he'd be like, all right, you know. Yeah. I think I saw him doing that with Nightwing like several years ago.
I could see him doing a thing where he writes Batman. I can see anybody doing this, actually, where like you write Batman for this absolute DC, but it starts with Dick Grayson.
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah, I mean that interests me more, I guess. I don't know. It just, I understand. Friends used the phrase before, like have your cake and eat it too, and that's exactly what this is, right? This is allowing creators to fuck up the status quo without fucking up like the financial bottom line, right? But I feel like because this is never going to be the main DC universe.
You say that, but like
the main MCU became Ultimate.
Yeah, well,
Ultimate became the main MCU, I should say.
Right.
That, but also like I'm not saying that I don't think it's possible to capture the like the magic of the New 52 in the bottle again. I think like it's too far gone, but like I don't think that you can like undersell the attractiveness to the like elusive new reader of something that is like small, self-contained, brand new, and like a jumping on point. And if it were to be successful, like on the level, or even like nearly as like a half of as successful as the New 52, like I could see it becoming the main DC universe and like them phasing out the normal one. Or you know what I mean? I could see, or maybe not phasing it out, but it becoming the focus.
It's
almost like them getting to do like to test run a New 52. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I understand that, but I also feel like we say that the Ultimate Universe became the main universe, and like, yeah, kind of, sort of. But like ultimately Marvel's publishing the same continuity they've always been publishing.
And yes, I think that go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, but DC will do the exact same thing. They will take what works from this and they will go, it's 0 Hour 2. And then they smash it all together. And then the stuff that worked and was popular will be part of their main continuity. It's comics, you know, since the beginning of time, basically. There will be an absolute crisis. There will be, you know, how many fans actually know, how many like current younger comics readers actually know that Nick Fury wasn't Samuel L. Jackson the entire time? You know what I mean?
Sure.
And now he is. And that's just, That is going to happen at DC too, because it's a natural churn. There's that Bobby and Bob phrase, I believe, from around the launch of the New 52 about the churn. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh yeah.
But it'll happen. It'll happen, absolutely. It won't become the main DCU in the way that, you know, it won't absolutely be the, to make a pun there, it won't absolutely be the DCU, but all the elements that are good or that are worthwhile or worth exploring will somehow be absorbed into something that more or less resembles like the continuity. The same way how that, like, the best stuff from the New 52 is somehow still considered main DCU, even though it really makes no sense for that to be the case.
Right.
Like, none of Batgirl's stuff makes any sense.
No.
But they did it anyway. And the, you know, the Burnside stuff, that was meant to be some kind of, like, not an alternate universe necessarily, but it was meant to be this artsy DCU side thing, and it became so insanely popular that like the line was driven visually and aesthetically by Batgirl of Burnside for like several years, I feel. And that sort of thing could happen with this too, you know. Whatever the thing catches fire, that'll be the thing for a while.
Yeah, I could see that happening. I guess this just feels like the same old thing, even though it's obviously new. This doesn't feel like a radical reinvention of DC, which is what I'm always hoping for, to borrow a phrase from our friend Dan DiDio. I'm always hoping for the New 52 done right.
Well, that's right? Isn't that specifically the thing that Rich says in the article?
Yeah, but this isn't. But to me, this isn't that. Like, the New 52 was supposed to take the comics that you were already reading, take this world and gussy it up to make it look different enough, but to make it like the core characters that you cared about. And to make
Isn't
you want to read.
Is?
No, it's not, because it's a whole new continuity. It's not like the worst part of the New 52 was they threw the other stuff away. The best part of it was the creative approaches that were taken. So like I want those creative approaches with the continuity intact. And this isn't really doing that.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying? Like that's
yeah, I follow you. Yeah.
That's what I'm really hoping for. I would love for we've dreamed cast this on our Patreon, patreon.com/gc3cast, like someone like Mark Wade or Christopher Priest coming in, or Jonathan Hickman, and saying like, all right, here is the vision for the next 5 years of DC, and not throwing stuff away, you know, but Krakoa-ing it, just giving it new shape and new context. To me, that's really exciting, way more so than there being this like sister universe that might one day be more important but isn't quite there yet. Like that just doesn't really do it for me.
Yeah. My only caveat / pushback to that is I think as seen with Krakoa, really the only way you can tell interesting stories in Cape comics anymore is if they're not if they don't count. You know what I mean? As if they're not like in my opinion, this is the only way you can tell interesting stories, because the mainline DCU will always have to be the base status quo or return to a base status quo.
I guess it depends what you think of as interesting. I was thinking about this morning when I was prepping for the show. I was thinking about what was the last like in continuity DC book that felt really wild to me. And wild in a good way, right? And I think the answer is pretty clear. It's Christopher Priest's Deathstroke.
Deathstroke, yeah, absolutely.
Like, that's one that, like, it took chances. It played with the format a little bit. But ultimately, it didn't do anything. It didn't break Deathstroke for other creators. It was additive instead of subtractive in terms of, you know, bringing things in and making it interesting. But the problem is that when Priest's run is done, it just kind of goes away, right? Like certain things hung around, but not really. Priest Run is sort of a beginning, middle, and end. It reminds me of Starman in a lot of ways, actually, where like it's this sort of definitive take on this character, and then it just go, you know, everything else will sort of reference it, but never really touch it again. I'd be way more interested if the mainline DC had three books that were going for it the way Deathstroke went for it, versus having this side universe.
Yeah.
Well, I think we already sort of kind of have that in some books that I think are trying to go they're trying to go for it the way Priest Deathstroke did.
You're thinking of The Flash and Wonder Woman, correct?
And I would even maybe lump like Green Lantern in there too.
The Jeremy Adams Green Lantern book?
Yeah.
I think less has happened in however many issues of Wonder Woman that have been released than happened in issue one of Deathstroke. But that's just me.
Issue one or issue zero? We're getting technical here.
Issue zero. That's right. There's a zero.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not down on this idea. Like, I think there could be good stuff here. I just this is the problem with wild speculation, right? Is that I had this idea in my head of what this was going to be, and this isn't that. And so I'm going into it like kind of bummed out already, but that's dumb. I should just take it as it's going to come. And I'm sure there will be creative teams that will get me excited. Do we want to speculate any writers we think might be part of this, or artists might be part of this?
I mean, I'm sure Snyder, Tynion, Wade, artists probably like. Dan Mora will probably be involved.
I think Capullo's a lock because of his partnership with Snyder.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, for at least like the opening arc, I could see it.
Yeah.
A little birdie told me maybe Al Ewing.
I could see Al Ewing.
I could see that,
sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you want to hear my swing here? I think that Brian Bendis is going to get a book in this.
Oh, man. Just because he's got nothing else to do or what?
Well, it seems like his bridge is burned at Marvel. Like, you would think that his DC exclusive is up. He's doing stuff with Dark Horse. You would think that Marvel would be welcoming him back. Bendis is coming back would be their, you know, their tagline. Because he's just such an important... He is the Scott Snyder of Marvel, right? He is the creator that sort of came out of a fallow time and became a superstar. He has way more value to Marvel than he does to anywhere else. And you would think they would find something to do with him. And there hasn't been a peep of Bendis doing stuff. And just knowing Bendis the way we know him, he likes playing in these big continuities. He likes taking on marquee characters. It just makes sense to me. I really thought, so when there were the rumors that Image was going to take over the Transformers and G.I. Joe IPs, I thought Bendis was going to get a Transformers comic. Because that seemed like a big enough deal for Bendis to do that it wouldn't feel like a step backwards for him. So I think you're going to see Bendis have a book here. Oh. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if Bendis and John Romita do a book together.
Nah.
Yeah, it's a great excuse for me not to read it. I mean, that's, you know.
I mean, I'm grimacing because I think you might be right.
Yeah.
You know who I think will get a book?
Is that
who?
Jason Aaron.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Why not?
In fact, yeah. I would go as far as to say this is why he is at DC now.
Oh, good call.
Oh,
good
I know. Call. I think he's getting the relaunch Justice League whenever that comes back.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
The more I think about that, like, he got his turn. He's doing his Batman mini. He's doing his arc on action. He's setting up the pieces for Justice League.
I don't think he would want to do Justice League so soon after doing Avengers. I think he is just doing these small things until they can let him go wild on Absolute. That's my read.
I could see that. Yeah. We should say this news will be out by the time this episode comes out. But Gail Simone is doing a run on Action Comics this summer, and I wouldn't be surprised if Gail Simone has a book in this.
Oh yeah, I kind of would either.
I would be, only because I think she'll be preoccupied. Like, again, the Action Comics thing is only going to be like a 3-issue
Exactly, yeah.
Run, but I think her X-Men stuff is going to keep her from doing anything much heftier than that, would be my guess.
She was always doing like 2 or 3 ongoings at the same time back in the day.
Yeah, but, well, okay, maybe.
I don't know.
I wonder if they could get Matt Fraction back for anything.
Oh, that's a good call.
And somebody I've always wanted to see work at DC, not Hickman. I mean, yes, Hickman, but it's not who I'm going to say. But I've said this before on the show, too. Kieran Gillen.
Yes.
Certainly he doesn't need to be doing, like, he could just go out and create our own comics, but he's one who always keeps his foot in the door at Marvel, too. But since he's done with the X-Men stuff at Marvel, I wonder.
It seems like he's done at Marvel for now.
Yeah.
I feel like I've gleaned that, or have seen people glean that from like social media stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that would be cool, interesting.
It'd be cool if he got a book over there, because he rocks.
I think Ewing is a lock, though. I think you're right about that, because I almost kind of feel like he's sort of not on the way out at Marvel, but definitely like I could see DC luring him away, because like Marvel has kind of like criminally underutilized him for years, and yeah, I could definitely see that.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he shows up.
Then Zach is all in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If they can get Donny Cates and Al Ewing.
Well, that's what I said in Lad's chat. You know, I've aside from my commitments to the DC3 cast, I've been like, so this started because I want to read Al Ewing's Venom. I felt like I should also read Donny Cates' Venom, since they're so like closely connected.
Sick fuck.
And so I started reading that. And then it's just got me thinking, like, this whole period from, like, 2018 to 2020, like, Jason Aaron and Donny Cates and Al Ewing were all, like, cooking off of each other's work continuously and doing some really interesting stuff. And it's been a while since we've had that kind of, like, creative synergy at DC. Like the writers at DC are like working very collaboratively right now, you know, between like, you know, the stuff that Josh Williamson is setting up, and then Tom Taylor and Mark Waid like playing off of it, but like none of it really interests me. I don't know. I would like to see some really cool like creative synergy going on. And not to say that, you know, Jason Aaron hasn't written anything that I've liked in a while, and Donny Cates, you know, who knows where he's at after, you know, the stuff with the accident, but yeah, I don't know. I can only speculate.
Do you think there's going to be a sort of division of labor between people who are doing, like, if you're doing an absolute book, are you not doing a mainline book?
I don't necessarily think so. That's just me. Only because I think that limits them too much.
Well, I just wonder, because here's the thing, like, if you're trying to make this the heavy hitters of DC, then you're pulling people away who are like my reason for asking this is Josh Williamson.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he is doing such big work on mainland DC, as is Tom Taylor. Do you see those guys getting pulled away from that to do this ultimate stuff? Absolute stuff, whatever.
Well, it seems like Tom Taylor's kind of he's wrapping up Nightwing, his run on Nightwing.
Is he?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's entering in his final arc, he has said.
But he's still doing Titans.
He's still doing Titans, but again, like, who knows how much longer Titans is going to last once Justice League comes back.
That's true.
I could see Taylor being pulled off to focus on Absolute and then whatever, you know, Dark Knights of Steel stuff he's working on. That, or not specifically that, but, you know, his other alternate universe stuff.
Right. I don't know. I kind of feel like there's maybe going to be a division of labor, at least in waves.
Yeah.
Like, it also depends how big, like, we have named like 20 creators that we have, yeah, be a part of this. This might be 3 books to start, right? It might be 5 books. We just don't know. Like, I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, maybe the first
I think
wave.
It's going to be 52 books.
Oh, man.
Who'd have thunk it? But, you know, maybe we're going to see, like, for the first wave of books, it's just going to be people who don't have stuff in the main line. But then when the second wave gets announced or whatever, they'll add to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe.
There are so many ways this could go wrong. And probably so many ways it could go right. Just vibes-wise, are we feeling... Is this going to be fun?
I think it's going to be fun. I after yesterday's article, I had almost no interest in it. After today's article, I was all in. So
I had almost the exact opposite reaction. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Never change, you guys.
Oh,
Vince, what about you, vibe wise?
I'm down. It's draft season. I'm up for anything. Give me some names. The only thing I'll take exception with to Rich on this is he teased it as, you know, 14 years ago or whatever, we teased the entire New 52 lineup, and now it's time to do it again or whatever. And I'm sorry, but you got to bring me some names. You got to bring me some titles, you know, like,
yeah,
that New 52 coverage was insane because he had everything, like, for all his faults and for, like, the scummy stuff that he's done over the years in the name of quote unquote journalism. He had all that New 52 stuff before anyone else did.
Yes, he did.
And it was so enthralling to, like, log in every morning and see what titles, what teams were being leaked. So I want to capture that feeling again. I want that back.
Well, he also had all of the Rebirth stuff, if you recall. Like, I remember there was a specific post where he got the name of New Superman before anyone else had that name. And, like, all that stuff was really exciting too. I just love the wild speculation stuff. I love, you know, we're all suckers for it. But I'll say that New 52 coverage just was, it hit so different.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't know if
and
we'll
maybe
ever get
maybe
back
we'll
to
get some. Maybe we will get some of it, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe Scott Snyder really is the leaker and he's going to start feeding everything to Rich.
Let's go.
But yeah, I'm interested. I hope it is. I hope it's cool. I hope it's good. Maybe we'll get, you know, more of an inkling about what it all looks like once Absolute Power gets going. You know, we've got the Free Comic Book Day issue coming out in a few weeks.
Yeah, that's coming soon.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Just have to wait and see. The ETA on this is something like October-ish.
San Diego Comic-Con?
The announcements. Yes,
for the announcements.
Yeah.
Man, that's even an old school throwback. Remember announcing stuff at San Diego?
Yeah. Right.
Nobody wants to work anymore, so they don't do that anymore.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's talk about our one quarter of it, one third of a comic, whatever we're setting it is. It is the backup to Harley Quinn, number 39. It is called Quinzel Cosmic Corsair, which is written and illustrated by Erica Henderson. And I forget which of you boys decided we should read this, but thank you for doing that. This was fun.
Well, I think I was at least part of it, if not Zach as well.
Yeah, Vince, I think, originally mentioned it, and then I said I had flipped through it and that it looked fun. So mm-hmm. I think that was the sequence of events there.
So somebody now,
meaty it is not. It is extremely slight. It's only like what? It's not even 10 pages. It's like 8 pages or something.
If that, yeah.
But it's fun and it looks great. I mean, that's the major draw is Erica Henderson's art, which I think is just, it's so cartoony and so goofy and fun and kind of perfect for Harley, I think. And there's an annual coming out where I think the whole thing is done by Henderson.
Oh,
I think actually that's next week. So I'm really excited about that, but this being as short as it is, I'm afraid there's not going to be much for us to talk about. But
we can talk about how horny it is.
It's very horny. It's very horny. That's great. I love the gag. It's a string of gags basically about Harley like subverting this narrator that is trying to throw things at her. And then you find out that it's in a dream. And so that's all it's done in a, actually that sounds worse than it actually plays out on the
page.
I
was just going to say that somehow sounds worse than it really is. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In reality, it's very fun and cute and funny how they do it. And it provides some really great imagery. Like at one point, I'll let you guys talk in a second, but at one point, there's a Green Lantern. It looks like the Yellow Submarine or something from the Beatles cartoon. But it's a Green Lantern, like floating dirigible that's coming after her.
Mm-hmm.
And basically Harley's like, we're just going to ignore that. Like, the whole thing is about Harley like brushing off everything that the narrator throws at her, just like off her back. And yeah, like that image alone of like the Green Lantern dirigible or of the like weird crab monsters, like all that stuff looks so good. It's so fun. Somebody else talk about it. That's all there really is to this story, but
yeah,
it's just nice to look at.
Yeah, and what I enjoyed about this is that I feel like the Harley Quinn stories that we usually get told, like to be fair, Harley is one of the hornier characters in DC, especially over the last couple of years when they've stopped just hinting around her and Ivy's relationship and made it canon. But I love how fun this is. Both from a storytelling perspective of like all the different weird, like the Green Lantern dirigible, like you mentioned, and the various encounters that she has, but also just the idea of we can let this character have this fun little horny dream and not take itself too seriously and just celebrate this really cool looking art. And why not? Just it's just fun, and it doesn't feel pretentious or too worked on. It's just a fun little thing that is a treat at the end of the book, and that's fantastic.
Yeah. And the character designs themselves look really different and interesting. They don't look like the normal Harley and Poison Ivy. They look cooler than they usually do, even, I feel like. And I want Henderson to do a Green Lantern book now, just based on how cool that like spaceship thing looks. It's like so short, but it doesn't feel slight.
It tells a complete story, right? Like,
yeah,
it does. Yeah.
Yeah. It ends with a booty call text as well.
Yeah. It's a good gag through and through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I was going to say, the only part that I thought was kind of strange actually was the Green Lantern page. I thought that the weird, you have like the one big panel that takes up like the top two thirds of the page. And then you have like a smaller panel down at the bottom and then like a weird bit of negative space off at the bottom. Which I thought just like looked a little weird. It almost looks like the kind of weird effect you get when you have digital first comics that get turned into print comics. Yeah. That's kind of what it made me think of. But that's like the smallest quibble, you know, with the book.
I also I wonder if that will look better in print.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe they'll stick an obtrusive ad right there so that maybe you can, like back in the old days.
Yeah.
I did think that too. I thought maybe just to fill that space, they could have used one more panel of it like zooming onto the, like you get the big shot of the submarine or whatever up on the top, maybe like a medium sized one and then the smaller one.
Yeah.
I'm not telling, you know, Erica Henderson or anybody at DC how to do their job. I did think like, that page needs something right there. it does seem like it was maybe meant for some other medium or something. And it just ended up, or like later in the comic, there are some panels that kind of do that where there's more space around them, but it's because we're realizing that Harley's dreaming. Mm-hmm. Like when she's right about to wake up, there's some like white space all around those panels, but it's different. It's the way it's done on that Green Lantern page is definitely more like awkward and noticeable than later, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas later it's done to effect. Whereas I don't think there's any effect right there on that double pager. I see what you're saying there. The big take home point though, that I think Brian said nicely is that it doesn't try to be more than it is, you know, it doesn't take itself too seriously and it doesn't have to be like, it knows what it is. And Henderson knows exactly what it is. It's a dreamy little story. And then the other thing about stories about dreams, sometimes I find that they're like too obtuse. Like the writer makes them too dreamlike. Like the dream logic is too heavy. But I think Harley like directly kind of mentally combating the narrator gives you that through line so that the dream logic, it's not stuff that doesn't make sense. It's dream logic, but it's with a goal in mind. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I don't like stories that use dream logic and then they chalk it all up to, well, it was just a dream. So, you know, if that didn't make sense, that's why, you know?
Right. Right.
This story doesn't do that. I really liked it.
Very few bits of media do dreams well.
Yeah.
The Sopranos is like number one
Sopranos, David Lynch.
Yes.
Yeah. Who else? The Wild Strawberries guy. I can't think of his name right now.
Yeah. Yeah. The Simpsons. There are some great Simpsons dream sequences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ingmar Bergman is the
there we
I
go.
Was looking for.
Yes. Yeah,
there we go.
Yeah.
yeah. So take home point, Harley Quinn, number 39, backup, just as good as an Ingmar Bergman movie.
Yes. The seventh seal, this is. All right. So for our last bit of the show this week, we talked about doing this and here we are, we're doing it. This stuff tends to now live on our Patreon, patreon.com/cc3cast. But we decided it would be fun to do a little bit of music chat here because there was a new Vampire Weekend record released last week, Only God Was Above Us. And we have talked about Vampire Weekend in the past. We all have some pretty strong opinions on Vampire Weekend. And so, Zach, why don't you kick it off? What do you think? Where does this rank for you in the general Vampire Weekend discography?
I'm actually still not sure, because I've come down on the album slightly since it came out. I still think I definitely know I don't like it better than Modern Vampires of the City. And I think that I still probably like it better than the other three albums. But as we have discussed behind the scenes, I think that for me personally, its closest competition, and this is like going to be, I think, semi-heretical, is Father of the Bride. Because I think, like, as flawed of an album as Father of the Bride is, I think it has some of the highest highs of any Vampire Weekend album for me personally. And that album is like hurt by its fluff and what I would consider filler. I know Ezra Koenig probably doesn't consider it filler, but my problem with Only God Was Above Us is that I think it's like really technically good, and there are some songs on there that I really like, but I think the overall average is that it's just a good Vampire Weekend album, not necessarily a great one for me. And also just a little bit of like extra added stuff. Like, I don't think I like the first two albums as much as you guys do. Like, older Vampire Weekend for me is it's not on the same playing field as like Modern Vampires Onward.
Well, I have some thoughts about that, but Vince, I want you to talk first.
Sure. I think this might be my favorite. I might be in the honeymoon phase with
you
it.
You are.
Shut up. Just kidding.
This is a very Zach thing for you to do.
It is a very Zach thing for you to do, yeah.
I'm the one who is usually most susceptible to recency bias, I feel like.
Yeah. And I'm aware that I may be doing that, but here's the thing. If it's not my favorite, it's definitely second to Modern Vampires. But I listened to them both back to back the other night. And there were Modern Vampires is great. It's a great, like an all-timer. There's a couple parts on it, though. First of all, I no longer like the parts where Ezra Koenig does the spoken word stuff.
That's always bad. Almost every band that does spoken word stuff, cut that shit out.
Yeah, I used to like that. I used to think like, oh, this is an interesting turn for Vampire. And now I listen to it and I'm like, I don't, it's kind of cringy actually. And then
it was always cringy, but I still like it.
Yeah. And
Hudson's
I don't know,
it's a bad song.
Okay, again, I wouldn't say it's bad. I wouldn't say it's bad. But
it's my least favorite song on the
absolutely,
album.
Absolutely, yes.
No question. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
In fact, I'm glad that they close out with Young Lion, even though it's like kind of a nothing of a song.
Because it washes the taste out of your mouth.
Exactly. Like if it ended on Hudson, it would kind of bring down the album a little bit for me.
Yeah. And see, right now when I listen to Only God Was Above Us, so we had talked previously that it was Brian had said The Surfer is the one bad song on the album. I said
The Surfer is the Hudson of the album for sure.
I definitely disagree, but we'll get to that later.
and Zach said he liked it, but maybe it was because he was listening to a lot of music that sounds like that lately. And I said it's the worst song on the album, but I still like it. And even that song really grew on me. And it's got like a funkier, like The rest of the rest of Only God was
lo-fi hip hop beats to study
it does.
To.
Thing. It absolutely does. That's really well said. That is what it is. And the rest of the album is, I think every other song on the album sounds like Vampire Weekend, except for
that song
one.
Sounds like the Beatles.
And whoa. It grew on me because I got the groove got in my head and I went along with it. I still think it's maybe it might be my least favorite song on the album still just by default, but I like it a lot more than I liked it on the first couple listens because it wormed its way in.
Let me just say, Vince, you ignorant slut. I'll talk about that in a minute, but I just want to get that out. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Where was I? But the thing about this album is so consistent. It's so beautiful. Like, it's so rich. One of the things that bugged me about Father of the Bride was that it was an Ezra Koenig album that the other guys just came and played on.
They didn't play at all on it.
On the tour with is what asshole.
Well, the reason I'm saying that is I had thought they played a little bit on the record. I didn't know until like last week they didn't play at all on the record.
I didn't know that either, I don't think. I thought that they at least worked on it to some degree. Okay, that's, yeah.
No, they didn't. It was Ezra and it was various other participants. Like, I'm pretty sure...
Well, that's why, like, I have always,
like, any of the names right now, but
yeah, well, since it came out, I have viewed it more as like a
Steve Lacy,
yeah, Steve Lacy, like, yeah. And Daniel Haim,
yeah.
It has seemed more like a Ezra Koenig, like, spinoff project, you know,
yeah,
but like, yes and no, because to be fair, it's always like it used to be him and Rostam's band, like, those were the two like power figures in the band, right. And like even on Contra, the other two guys are on it way less. Like, there's a lot more electronics, and there's a lot more drum loops and stuff on there, you know. So it's they're already less important. By Modern Vampires, those guys basically are just like they're studio musicians who play. The impression I got was they're just playing what the other two guys are telling them to play. So when Rostam leaves, it makes sense that the power vacuum all goes to Ezra. This one feels more equitable towards the guys in the band, but like other people play drums and bass on this album too. It's not like it's really a bad album.
Well, but it's not. So it doesn't matter if it's like necessarily if you know, like if somebody else is playing stand up bass and somebody else is playing drums on this one song, like it sounds more like an album that was made by a group of people in the same room.
Yes.
Than Father of the Bride does to me, which Father of the Bride to me, and you can get up my ass about this all you want, it sounds like a few great ideas for some songs that Ezra Koenig had that he could not realize in a fully formed way because of, was that during COVID?
No,
it was before COVID.
No, well, then what was the excuse for I guess Rostam leaving, maybe.
Yeah.
But what, anyway, and then like an EP of songs with guest artists like Daniel Haim and Steve Lacy that I fully believe just belong on a different project or collection or something. This sounds so rich. It sounds so like every song is so like layered and fully formed. And I think the argument against it would be that like then nothing stands out in the way that like This Life on Father of the Bride stands out or right, Harmony yeah. Hall. Like there's yeah. you may say there's not those highs on this, but to me, I put this thing on and it's so rich from beginning to end that I like sink into it and it just feels really good all the way through.
Yeah.
Versus Father of the Bride, where like every other song, I'm like, do I hit the skip button right now? Do I tell Siri to shut off this stupid unbearably white song. You know,
well, so here is why you're an ignorant slut.
Okay.
Because the Surfer is exactly what you're talking about right now. The Surfer is the song that doesn't fit. It might be good. It doesn't fit on this album at all.
I don't think that it doesn't fit.
Oh, I think I think it's very jarring. I think by the end of it, it fits.
I think it's a nice little cleanser ahead of Gen X Cops.
I really don't think it fits very well.
Even if it doesn't, like, even if I grant you that it doesn't fit, it's that's one song that doesn't fit versus sure. like seven. No, that
I'm not saying it's the same thing, but I'm saying that, like, what you're saying about it, not like those things not fitting. I think if you pulled the Surfer out, the record feels a lot, even it already feels cohesive. It feels even more cohesive without that on there.
It would be cutting out. I actually tiered these. I made a tier list for these songs.
All right. Well, we'll get to that. Can I give my general thoughts on the album?
Sure,
before we
sure.
Get to
the yeah,
tiers?
Yeah.
So I my sort of overarching theory of Vampire Weekend is that their odd numbered albums are great and their even numbered albums have the better songs but are worse albums. But I think the two best songs from a songwriting and production standpoint of the first two Vampire Weekend records are Cousins and Giving Up the Gun, which come back to back on Contra. Those two songs are perfect. Like, there is nothing out of place. The first album, the production sounds a little thin in parts, whatever. Those two songs sound like fucking hits. They're great. But the rest of Contra is kind of shitty. There's some there's five maybe great songs on Contra, and then the rest is total filler I never need to hear again.
I think Diplomat Son is a better song than either of those two.
Oh,
but...
no, Diplomat Son is one of the filler tracks I would cut from
oh,
that
my gosh.
100% would
insane.
Cut that. No.
That's one of the best songs on the album. That
it's
is
boring and bad.
The best song
on
the album.
No way.
Yeah, I think it is.
No.
Giving Up the Gun is very boring and is a filler.
No, Giving Up the Gun is fucking great.
No, it's fine.
That's the best song they've ever written.
I agree.
I'm with you there, Brian. You there.
And then Father of the Bride has, we might disagree on what the best songs are, but there's like six or seven great songs on that album that kind of get pulled down by the fluff around it. And so for some reason, those two records, the wheat and the chaff, are so easily separated. To me, the other three, with the exception of a song or maybe two on each of those, those albums just hang together as albums better. Like, what I did for this was I listened to the new record, then the first record, the new record, then the second record, the new record. So I listened to the new record four times and paired it with one of the first four albums each time I listened to it.
Interesting, because I actually did a similar, I didn't do it as methodically as you, but I probably had the same
ratio.
Yeah.
Okay. And like, the album it most reminds me of is the first album, in the sense that both those albums have, I don't want to say one sound, because that's not true, but there's sort of like a thesis statement sound that runs through all the songs but the Surfer on the new album. And the first record has that kind of thesis sound that runs through most of those songs also. Modern Vampires is the most diverse sound they have, but aside from Diane Young, no song on Modern Vampires stands out as like the hit. Does that make sense? Like, all these other albums, there's the hit. That one has, or the hits rather. There's
See,
two
I always
songs.
Think of Step as the hit from that album.
Oh, no,
I know
Diane
Young
is
was
the
first
hit,
single, but I always think of Step as the hit from that album.
Oh, no. See, to me, Diane Young is clearly the best song on that album. Like, in terms of just like,
oh, I don't think
songwriting, production, like everything about it just fits together really well. It's not my favorite song on the album. It's the best song. There's a difference there.
I guess so. And maybe it's because it was the first single, but I don't not like it, but I think less of it.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. I don't agree with that at all. I see, like, to me, and again, like you, the difference in our ages, I probably didn't hear Diane Young until I bought the album.
Yeah.
Like, you were probably more tuned in to the singles at that point than I was.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like, to me, the first, third, and fifth albums all hang together as better albums. And so I think that this album doesn't have a hit to me on it the way that there's clearly, and again, I don't mean hit like selling a million copies or being on the pop charts. I mean, like, there's not that like punch to the gut. This is the best, biggest, whatever song on it. Like, I like a lot of these songs a whole lot, but there's none of them rise to me to the level of Diane Young or Cousins or Giving Up the Gun, or Harmony Hall or This Life. Like, there's a certain, there's not that undeniable, like, this is the important capital I song on the record. I'm gonna guess that classical becomes that for me the more I live with it, because that is, I think that's the maybe the best song on the album. And again, in terms of just like from a songwriting production,
you're not
all
like
that
my
together.
Tier list.
That's fine. I do not expect to ever like
we have to be different.
We do have to be different. But I also think we come to music looking for different things.
We do,
a lot
yeah.
of times.
We do, yeah.
But yeah, so that's sort of, those are my overall thoughts on it. I will say that I am growing tired. I'm not quite there yet, but song titles like Prep School Gangsters and Gen X Cops are just, they sound like AI Vampire Weekend titles. Just really, really on the nose. Ice Cream Piano, same. Just like these very, very on the nose song titles. I could see myself getting a little tired of eventually, but that's a minor complaint. So give me your tears here, Zach.
Well, why don't we just go through the track list and I'll tell you what tier it ended up in.
How many tiers do you have?
I have S is the highest, D is the lowest.
How many are there?
S, A, B, C, D. It's just a normal tier list.
Oh, okay. That's too many tiers for 10 songs.
No, it's just a normal tier. Nothing is in D. I'll say that. Nothing's in D.
Okay. Ice Cream Piano.
That's S tier.
Classical.
That's C tier.
God damn it. Capricorn.
Capricorn is high B tier.
Connect
is top of A tier.
Prep School Gangsters.
That's A tier.
The Surfer.
That is all B tier.
Gen X Cops.
Low A tier.
Mary Boone.
Mary Boone is in the contention for, it's between Ice Cream Piano and Mary Boone for top song for me. So it's also S tier.
Pravda.
B tier.
Hope.
Hope and Pravda are low B tier for me.
So Classical is your least favorite song on the album.
Yeah, it is. Right
wow.
Now. Right now.
Wow. That's
because I don't like the lyrics really. I think it's one of the most basic Vampire Weekend songs I've ever heard.
I never listened to their lyrics. That's a band I don't give a shit about their lyrics.
Sure.
That's funny.
So yeah. I think lyrically it's pretty boring. I joked that it could be a Taylor Swift song because something about the progression and the like lyric choices immediately reminded me of a Taylor Swift song. That was like the very first thing I thought of.
I could see that. Yeah.
It aside from the like sax bit and the standing bass, I think it's like a pretty, for me, it's like a pretty pretty forgettable song.
See, the way that this album uses upright bass just speaks to my soul. Mm-hmm. I love when a band uses both electric and upright bass at the same time. I think that's one of the coolest things you can do as a band in terms of just giving your record something that's sonically really different. So I adore that part of it. And I just think that this, like, what I like about this album for most of these songs is that even though there's a ton of different sounds like within it, it's not like on Father of the Bride, there are songs that sound totally out of place because there's this or that influence that is like overpowering. This, all the weird shit that gets added in, nothing really overpowers the songs except again, I think the Surfer does get overpowered by the differences. And that's...
I almost kind of think Gen X Cops almost gets a little overpowered by like how raucous it is, like how the guitars are just so strong in that one. But I like it, but it's a lot, I think.
And the one thing I didn't say at the beginning was I think this is probably my third favorite Vampire Weekend record. I don't think anything will dethrone the first one for me just because of like where I was in my life when I heard it.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think that those songs are fantastic. But I think that it'll go like Vampire Weekend, Modern Vampires of the City, Only God Was Above Us, Father of the Bride, Contra. Contra is by far my least favorite Vampire Weekend record.
I'm pretty mercurial when it comes to Contra, but on this most recent listen, I think I agree with that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So your current rankings have
It would be something like Modern Vampires, Only God Was Above Us. I could go back and forth on their debut and Father of the Bride and then Contra.
And Vincey, what would your rankings be?
Only God Was Above Us. For right now, Only God Was Above Us, Modern Vampires, self-titled, Contra, Father of the Bride.
Wow, okay.
We're all different.
Yeah, yeah.
And special in our own ways.
Yeah.
But all of us have Contra in one of the bottom two spots and Father of the Bride in one of the bottom two spots right now.
Yeah. I thought I was higher on Contra, and then like it's really only like the first three or four tracks and then Diplomat Sun for me.
Yeah. Diplomat Sun is easily the track I would cut from that album first.
Oh, I love it.
Man. Part of it is when I saw them live, that was fucking terrible.
Did they do, because it take they like do an extended version,
yes,
of it, don't
and,
they?
And they were clearly using backing tracks but pretending they weren't at that point in the show. Yeah. And like, again, if you're gonna use it, like, own it, right? But they were just like, they were trying to pretend like they weren't, and then Chris Baio was doing this stupid dance with his bass the whole time, and it was just the whole thing just drove me crazy, and the song went on forever.
I think he just does that. I was just watching a video of them live, and he was doing that for a completely different song. So
yeah,
I think he just does that.
Yeah, it was just bothersome. But like to me, I hate Horchata, and that's maybe
Horchata. I really like it.
To me, that is the Mad Libs of Vampire Weekend songs, like Horchata, Balaclava. All those words are just like, it's just the white people words you expect them to use. Like, it's just, it's the worst. To me, it's from Taxi Cab through Giving Up the Gun is like, that's a perfect four song run. Okay. And the rest of the album I could get rid of. I don't give a shit.
Yeah, I like White Sky too. I like both of those.
It's your favorite album then?
No, you not just hear what I said that I like the first three songs and then Horchata, White Sky. I actually don't even like Holiday that much.
Oh,
Holiday
is fine.
Holiday. It's
give
fine.
Me
ho- it's
give
fine.
Me
I like
Holiday
California
through Diplomat
English.
Son.
I like California English better than Holiday.
Oh, I think I hate California English too. Yeah,
I like California. I like 3 through 9. The closer kind of stinks. I think you're a Contra. It's like a nothing song.
I'm probably being meaner to giving up the gun than I should be. It's a fine song.
Oh, I really think that
it's
is
a
their
classic.
Best song. Yeah.
It's like it. The problem is A-Punk is their like most well-known song because it's the Vampire Weekend meme song that they came out with, and that was their sound, right?
Yeah.
And Giving Up the Gun doesn't necessarily sound like the meme version of Vampire Weekend, but it is their best. It like in any other band's hands, that's like their big hit. That's like the big pop, perfect pop mm-hmm. song, you know? Plus, what? Jake Gyllenhaal was in the video.
That's true. Yes. You know? I also love the video for Cousins. Do you remember that video where it's like them in the alley?
I don't know if I remember it.
It's them in an alley and they're on these like almost like the camera is attached to these little like carts they're on, just like zooming back and forth. It's just a cool video. I don't know how to describe it. But to me, the those songs back to back are so different, but they're both so great. And to me, those are both taking like the sounds of the first album and elevating them in a way. Whereas so much like Horchata's boring. I Think You're a Contra is boring. California English is boring. It's not elevating what the first record was doing for me. Though these are like the refined version of the first record sounds taken to a new place. And and yeah. But yeah. All right. And are we done with our Vampire Weekend chat for now?
I think so.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
You want to know why The Surfer probably grew on me a little bit?
Is it Chum Boy listen to
I
it?
I think, yeah, yes. No, I think Rostam has been experimenting with the lo-fi beats to chill to or to study to or whatever sound, because he's got two tracks on Carly Rae Jepsen's latest album that he co-wrote with her, and one of them sounds very one of them's that very similar like lo-fi groove beat thing, and I think she suits it more than Vampire Weekend does singing over that, but I think it worms its way into me regardless. Like I kind of like that sound too, even if I don't think it fits necessarily with the rest of the album. Like it got me eventually. I like what he's doing. I like when he produces stuff with. I wish you were still a member of Vampire Weekend, actually.
Do I wish he was still a member of Vampire Weekend? Maybe. I don't know. I mean,
I want him to do whatever he wants to do. So he doesn't want to be a member of this.
No, I understand that. What I was going to say is I feel like I don't know if his contributions to the band work as well when he's the outsider. Like even the stuff he produced on Father of the Bride, I just think it doesn't sound as integrated into what they do.
Sure.
And I think it can seem I don't want to say a little much, that's the wrong word for it, but it's just a very different feeling when he was like a decision maker versus an influence on the decision. I don't know if that makes any sense at all. Yeah. All right. Well, this has been the DC3 cast for tonight. Thank you for listening. Vince, what comes out next week?
Nightwing Annual Number 1, The Flash Annual Number 1, Harley Quinn Annual Number 1, Superman House of Brainiac Special Number 1, DC Spring Breakout Number 1. I think that's it.
Well, we'll talk about something next week. Until then, go to dc3cast.com for more, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
We become the absolute DC3cast.